Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 13th, 2013. We've spent the last few weeks talking about the American dream, an idea that still resonates with millions of people. Getting a college degree, earning a good income, buying a home, retiring well. Today, we're focusing on one thing that can derail those dreams into a financial and emotional nightmare: health insurance. Not having it, not having enough, not knowing what's covered. Remember the last time your health went bad?
The beginning of this year, I went to the hospital. I had a virus. I'm glad I still had my health care at the time because I know it's really expensive if you go and paying out of pocket. If I got sick today, I would put all my trust in my young, healthy immune system.
Because of an accident that I was in, I needed a little bit of therapy for the back pain. Mm-hmm. So my doctor referred me to a chiropractor for therapy.
In April of 2012, I had myocarditis. So it was like I almost had like a mild heart attack. It was like my last year of college, and I went to the hospital, and I was there for maybe the entire weekend for three to four days. Of course, it was expensive. At the end of the day, like, my bill was actually like $10,000, but with health insurance, I got it for like $500, so I only had to pay $500.
That's the reason for health insurance: a hospital stay, a bill for $10,000, and you only have to pay $500. That's a positive financial outcome. But let's face it, our healthcare system doesn't always work. So this is a show for everyone, people who have coverage and people who don't. Today, we're imagining an American dream that's about life, liberty, and the pursuit of healthiness. What do you need to know to navigate our health system? How should you buy insurance, negotiate for a lower bill, and be a better advocate for yourself and your family? It's not exaggerating to say that in just 2 weeks, healthcare as we know it is changing. But no one knows how it will turn out. Come October 1st, Americans can start shopping for insurance under Obamacare. Dan Gorenstein covers all things healthcare for us and joins me from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for coming on, Dan.
Thank you.
What happens on October 1st?
So on October 1st, it's like the big day. It's like what all healthcare reporters like myself were like super geeked out about. Like, what happens? And what is really going to happen here is you get state exchanges and federally run exchanges all around the country are going to begin offering people who are currently uninsured. There are about 50 million of those people. They're going to start offering people insurance. So you can go online to a website sort of similar to a Travelocity and kind of shop for the healthcare plan that makes sense for you most. And people have from October 1st through March 31st to sign up for coverage. That coverage kicks in on January 1st. And so what people need to really appreciate is what it means to have insurance is you're going to have monthly premiums, you're going to have out-of-pocket costs, and you're going to be able to work within sort of a narrow network of providers, hospitals and doctors and specialists.
So one of the big questions I would imagine for people who don't have insurance or are interested in looking at the exchanges to see if they can buy a policy is, how much is this going to cost? I know it's a complicated answer. Walk me through it a little bit.
Sure, of course. The sticker price, the price that you actually see on the website, is going to be anywhere from like $150 to $650.
And that's per month?
That's per month. And that's before these federal subsidies kick in. Depending on how much money you earn a year, you will be eligible, and lots of people will be eligible, for some federal subsidy. It's up to 400% of the federal poverty line, which is about $46,000 for an individual, about $94,000 for a family of four.
So that means that a fair number of people could get a little help paying for one of these policies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they absolutely will. And one of the interesting things is that you could be a healthy 28-year-old and a sick 62-year-old, but if you're making the same money, if you're both making about $28,000 a year, even though that sticker price is going to be radically different, it's going to be between that $150 and $650 spread, you're going to end up paying the same amount because the subsidy, that's how the subsidies work. It really is a calculation based on how much you earn.
What happens if you're uninsured and you just decide to stay uninsured?
I think the reality is that a number of Americans are going to look and they're going to do some window shopping. And you know what? They're going to see that they're going to have to pay a lot of money for an insurance product that they might not even really want. It might not have the doctors or the specialists that they're looking for. It might just be too expensive, even with federal subsidies, even with financial help. And so what happens in that case if you decide, you know what, I'm not going to do it, is that you're going to, in year one, you'll be fined either $95 or 1% of your income, whichever is higher. And so for most people, it's going to be 1% of your income. And that penalty ratchets up. It gets higher in 2015 and higher again in 2016. And that's when we're not talking about 1% of your income. We're talking about a penalty that's got some real teeth to it.
If I'm trying to evaluate if this is the right thing for me, where can I go? What are my resources?
Well, the federal government has set up a website, healthcare.gov. A lot of states, if you live in one of 16 states, and I think the District of Columbia, they're setting up their own exchanges. You can contact them. You can also contact one of the federally run exchanges. There are people who are called navigators or ambassadors. That's the language that people are using. And I would strongly encourage anybody who's really thinking about, you know, what plan is best for me, to have a conversation, because this is very complicated. This is very dense stuff. And you need to understand, you need to appreciate how much money you make a year. You need to understand how sick you and your family are. And depending on those factors, it's really going to vary from person to person what kind of plan is best for you.
Dan Gorenstein covers healthcare for Marketplace. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We're spending this hour talking about healthcare. October 1st is when health exchanges will open. People who don't have insurance can shop around for plans. But here's the thing, and this affects everyone, those with private insurance, those with work plans. You might know how much your deductible is, but actual treatment can range, even in the same zip code. Unlike just about every other thing we spend money on, healthcare doesn't come with an upfront price tag. Elizabeth Rosenthal is a New York Times reporter and a doctor. She's spending a year investigating the cost of medical procedures in a series called Paying Till It Hurts. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You started this series by writing about colonoscopies. What did you learn about the average price for that procedure, but then also what a patient can do to get a sense of what they should be paying?
The average price is all over the place, is what I learned. That you know, within a given city and often within a given zip code, the price of a good colonoscopy can vary from $1,000 to $15,000, literally that much. And so what patients can do is they can ask beforehand what the price will be, because this is an elective procedure. The second thing I would recommend everyone do is ask about whether anesthesiology is included in that. What I saw from a number of patient bills was the big, big charge was not actually for the colonoscopy, but for the anesthesiologist who put you under. The other thing I would warn people is we like to say under the Affordable Care Act, these kind of screening procedures are going to be free to patients. But if anything is found during that procedure, like if there's a little polyp to take off, then it becomes not a screening procedure and you can be open to getting those bills. So I wouldn't just say, it's covered. It's not going to, you know, the price isn't going to matter to me, because it could well come back to matter.
This is also about how Americans are billed for their health care. It's not like we pay one price. Explain the pricing structure a little bit.
In this country, we pay a la carte for most services. So that means you have three ultrasounds. You pay for three ultrasounds. You also pay for the radiologist to read the ultrasounds often. And so when you order that way, things really, really add up.
That's what's known in the medical business as fee for service. You pay a fee for each thing that happens. Do you think that's what's behind just the really skyrocketing costs of healthcare?
There are plenty of other countries that do fee-for-service, but they don't consider everything a service. So we define the doctor and the operating room and the blood pressure cuff and the blanket and the Tylenol each as a separate service, and we pay separately for that often. And that's what's really gotten out of control.
Yeah, I was in the hospital last year, and I noticed that the price for what was my Tylenol was like $1.75 per pill. And I was thinking, that seems really excessive.
It's very unfair to consumers because you don't have a choice. If you knew that Tylenol was going to cost you $1.75, you would probably have your relative go out and buy one for, you know, 10 cents.
Yeah.
But you never have that choice in a hospital. You're just given things, and then your insurer is expected to pay.
I'm going to ask you to predict the future a little bit. The healthcare exchanges under the Affordable Care Act open in October. What are you going to be watching for when that happens?
I think the first thing to watch for when these new policies are open to consumers is what do they cover and how well do they cover. What we're seeing more and more is that insurance policies are not very soup to nuts. They carve out a lot of different things. So if an insurance policy says I cover maternity care or I cover a hip replacement, you want to know what does that mean. If it says I cover a hip replacement, will it cover rehab? The other thing I would add is that the Affordable Care Act, while it's really good at getting insurance for the millions of people who don't have it now, doesn't directly deal with this pricing issue. So I think it's still incumbent upon patients to ask again and again, and to go online. There are a lot of services now that will tell you what different providers in your area charge for a service. You can comparison shop. Now, that's obviously not going to work if you need your appendix out, but a lot of medical care like colonoscopy is elective. One of the ways that prices will come down is if people do become more price aware and price sensitive.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is an MD who reports for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, repeat after me. Every bill is a conversation.
There's actually a lot of leeway to negotiate with the hospital and agree on a price that's more affordable for the consumer.
How to haggle on healthcare. You can lower your costs. Plus, what happens when you are the family caregiver? That's ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're spending this hour talking about healthcare, and one of the most important conversations is also the hardest. What do you do about end-of-life care? Patients, families, and the country spend a disproportionate amount of money during that time. The last 2 years of life eat up more than a quarter of Medicare's spending and cost almost $70,000 on average. Those numbers come from Dartmouth. Dr. Jim Weinstein is the president and CEO of the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Health System. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I want to understand, why are the last 2 years of life so expensive when you talk about medical care?
These are very complicated times in the family. Caring for a loved one, parent, grandparent, is always a challenge in that I don't want to feel like I've let them down. I can give you a personal example. I lost my daughter, who wasn't an adult or a grandparent, but a child. And the dilemma that my wife and I went through at the end of her life, not wanting her to be in the hospital, but certainly wanting to do everything we could, really kind of puts it right in my heart. I think we knew that the end was near, but we also had to talk about it. And I think a lot of families don't either know how to talk about it, but I would encourage the listeners and their families to try as hard as it is to have open, honest discussions as a family, and then spend that time so that you're not in the hospital doing a lot of things to a loved one that probably won't matter as far as saving their life.
Dartmouth, where you are, has done something really on the forefront of looking at the cost of healthcare. You guys have compiled the Dartmouth Atlas, which looks at how much things cost in the healthcare system. I looked at one of your numbers, and you show that patients with chronic illness in the last 2 years of life account for about 32% of Medicare spending. And Medicare is a good proxy because it gives us something that we can study for the health system as a whole. How do you get that number down?
Most of us and most people who are dying, either they have a chronic illness or a cancer, we know that there is some point at which it's probably not really working, if we're honest with ourselves. And I think that amount of money in those last couple years really is a product of what we've gotten used to as a society, right or wrong. And I don't sit here judging it. I sit here saying I question it, whether people who were well-informed and had the right discussions would want heroics done in those last few moments, more ICU bed days. Would they really want that if they had that honest discussion?
Explain to me the difference between a unit that's devised to just provide comfort to someone with a chronic illness and lessen their pain versus the traditional way we think of a hospital, how those doctors and care providers charge for their services.
The difference is, as you allude to, Lizzie, is how things are paid for. Most patients just assume, and their families assume, wherever they're getting care, that their insurance or somebody else is going to pay for it. When you're in an environment of a hospital, the dollars we spend to do every little thing runs the cash register up faster than you can imagine. In the hospice palliative care space, you're not in that expensive space for rent, where equipment and personnel is much less expensive. So being in an environment that's less costly, but no less caring. The patients I've visited in hospice palliative care facilities, it's really just dealing with their pain and discomfort so that they may pass on to their next world in a safe and comfortable way. We don't know as a patient or a family, we trust our doctors and our health system to tell us, you know, this is where you should be. But based on the kind of discussion you and I are having, Lizzie, I hope more people will ask those questions. Could my mother not be in a place to keep her comfortable that might be less expensive and better for her?
Jim Weinstein is the president and CEO of the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Health System. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie. It was great to be with you today.
You just heard Jim Weinstein say what any family caregiver knows all too well. Taking care of a loved one is hard. Emotionally, physically, financially. Long hours without pay. And it's a full-time job many Americans find themselves doing. Nearly 42% of U.S. workers have cared for an aging family member or friend in the last 5 years. That's according to the AARP. They've taken time off because professional care is just too pricey and insurance rarely covers the full cost of home care. Christian Spratt is taking care of her grandparents in Knoxville, Tennessee. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Give me an outline of what your situation is right now and what you're doing as a caretaker.
Essentially, I live in my grandparents' home. I am their, for lack of a better word, 24/7 caregiver. I stay in the home with them. I basically run their household, kind of almost like a Carlson on Downton Abbey. You get the groceries done, you get the doctor's appointments done. Every facet of their lives is something that I directly supervise and facilitate.
Tell me about their health.
My grandfather is 85 years old. He has Alzheimer's. It's in the earlier stages, but it is progressing, and there's nothing you can do about that. My grandmother, while mentally she has no Alzheimer's or dementia, she's losing a little memory and the things that would be expected from living that long.
Both of your grandparents have Medicare, and I'd imagine when you first started trying to figure this out, you looked at what Medicare covered, what it didn't, what options were out there for you. What did you find?
I found that, surprisingly, that the options are limited. My grandfather, number one, is a World War II Marine, so I figured there would be veteran services. He's also a retired federal worker. He retired, you know, from the post office. So I thought there would be some federal benefit. They're luckier than most because they do have a Medicare supplement that he got for being a federal worker. But looking into it and working with a social worker, basically Medicare does not kick in until they have zero asset, they have lost everything, then Medicare will kick in. And at that point, the coverage is limited. So veteran services were not available to him because he did work, you know, his whole life, and he saved a little bit.
How does that make you feel?
A little stuck. Just with my life the way it is now, I have two options. Stay here, keep them in their home, do everything I can for their mental, physical well-being, and help them manage their finances and do so at the sacrifice of my own life. With my time with my husband still lives in another state. So I can do that, or I can throw in the towel and try to get them into a nursing home and completely bankrupt them and lose the house my grandfather built that he's so proud of. And you just feel like there's not enough you can ever do in any one direction.
Give me a sense of your financial picture before you headed in to start taking care of your grandparents.
I was making it. I was like anybody else out there today. I worked for a living. I paid my bills. There wasn't necessarily a lot left over at the end, but I had everything I needed.
And now, how do you feel?
I feel trapped. You know, what little income I do get does come, you know, from my grandparents. So, and since my savings is depleted, when this is over, whenever that is, 5 minutes from now, 5 years, there's nothing left. I will actually have to start my life over from scratch at that point.
When you think about what you would tell someone else who is going to take care of a parent or a grandparent, what would you tell them?
To not enter it lightly. I mean, as a mother, I kind of almost equate it when you're pregnant. You have people coming up to you going, your life is going to change forever. But it's kind of the opposite of parenthood, and that with you're raising a child to put them out into the world and make their life. With caretaking, you are easing them out of this world and helping them come to terms with the life that they've led. And for a lot of people, that's not a very pretty thing. In my instance, these are my grandparents, yes, but they're not my grandparents anymore. I know them and have an understanding of them on a personal level that you don't get growing up going to your grandma's for Sunday dinner. You need to be prepared to have everything about these people that you've loved your whole life stripped down to its most basic human element and have it be dirty and still be able to sleep at night and wake up the next day and do it all over again.
Christian Spratt is taking care of her grandparents. Christian, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you very much.
We want to hear from you. Your stories about health insurance and the conversations you've been having with your family and friends, you can write us at marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. We started the show today by talking about the health insurance exchanges that will open in 2 weeks under the Affordable Care Act. Millions of people without insurance will have the chance to see if the policies work for them and if they're affordable. Randy is one of them. He's been without insurance for about a year. He's at home in Peoria, Arizona. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you.
Randy, tell me your situation, how old you are, and what you're doing now.
I'm 54 years old. I am a retired plumber. I had to retire. I didn't want to. I don't want to be retired at 54. I have to live off Social Security income, which just about pays my house payment plus maybe a little more. So we basically rely on my wife for most of our bills. And she's a daycare provider at our house, and she's been doing it for many, many years. She's thought about trying to go out and find another job, but she doesn't, at her age, she's my age too, she cannot find another job that would cover for insurance or anything and still provide some income for our house.
May I ask you how much money you guys are bringing in now? What are you living off of?
I would say it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about $30,000 to $35,000 a year.
And how did you get sick? What happened?
I got a leg infection that's called cellulitis. It kept recurring, and I had to go to the hospital. So after 4 months of that, I went back to work. And later on in 2010, it came back.
What's it like to have serious health problems and not have insurance?
It's scary because I could wind up getting that leg infection again or something similar and wind up back in the hospital and, you know, another $30,000 to $50,000. But now I would have to figure out something else because I don't have the insurance to cover it.
Have you had to compromise on health care because you don't have insurance, either you or your wife?
Yes. Because of my health situation, I should be seeing specialists that I can't afford to go see. And my wife does not get her yearly, you know, women's things, mammograms, PAPs, and that kind of thing, because we can't afford for her to go to the doctor and have it done.
Have you thought about getting insurance through the Affordable Care Act?
I have thought about that, and I hope that it works out. I will be honest, I'm not a Obama fan, but I'm hoping that this is one thing that does work.
Have you looked at any of the options online?
Yes, I have. I've done some of the things, you know, where you go through and see if you qualify, the qualifying things. And I have looked at them. I can eventually qualify for Medicare, but we still have to provide for my wife. And I'm not completely convinced that it's going to be really affordable, you know.
I was going to ask you about that. How much do you think you could afford to spend every month on health insurance?
With our budget, we could probably squeeze out about $200 a month.
And do you have any sense of whether the Obamacare options are affordable to you?
I don't. I know some of the plans that we've looked at, some of the things that I've worked on, say that it can get down to about that. But then I wonder exactly what kind of coverage is that going to be? Is that going to be a coverage that's worth it?
When you think about the situation you're in, what would you like people to know about it?
I would like to find an insurance that actually does us some good. I'm not saying I want everybody to pay for my medical bills or pay for my problems. I just want something that will help us. Most people don't understand that not everybody can afford insurance every month, but I would like to have something that will take some of the pressure off of us if, for instance, I do have to go to the hospital or even if something happens to my wife.
Randy, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you for your time.
Even with insurance, you will, of course, get a bill. And usually it involves some combination of strange letters that signify a procedure and its cost. And if you're lucky, it's a manageable bill. But there are times when you get something in the mail and, whoa, sticker shock. There's one thing you need to remember. No price is set in stone. Really. You get a bill for service and you can negotiate. Jen Viechner is a writer for The Wall Street Journal and MarketWatch, and she's here to explain. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I think most people have no idea that you can negotiate a medical bill. What kind of power do consumers have?
They have a lot more power than most people think. You're right. You know, when you think about haggling and negotiating, maybe you're thinking more of the flea market. But actually with medical bills, there's actually a lot of leeway to negotiate with the hospital and agree on a price that's more affordable for the consumer.
I remember I was very sick and I received a bill from a hospital for $19,000. I almost had to sit down when I opened that envelope. Mm-hmm. What kind of steps could I take or can someone else take when you open that envelope, you see the huge number, what can you do?
a good place to start is asking, you know, going back to the hospital and saying, I can't pay this. And if you were planning on going through insurance, sometimes the price charged to insurance is different than what they would charge the consumer if they say, you know, can I just pay this in cash up front? Obviously, $19,000, you know, that's maybe not so feasible. It's more of like in an MRI situation where maybe it's going to be $2,000, but they'll give it to you for $500 if you can pay cash up front. In that sort of situation, though, it might be worth working out a payment plan, you know, asking if you can pay the bill in smaller installments over a matter of years. If you can work out a plan where you can pay it with no interest or very little interest over time, that might be more doable for a lot of people.
When you reported on this, you wrote about these companies and advisors who help people negotiate bills. What did you learn from them?
There are consumer advocates, and obviously you might say, well, I'm already dealing with this bill. How am I going to afford, you know, to pay for services like that? But some of them will actually work on commission if you really can't afford it. So they'll say, you know, I'll work to recover this amount of money for you, and they'll take a percentage so you don't actually have to pay them up front.
Until they actually kind of deliver for you.
Right. Like if, you know, that $19,000 bill, if they were able to work it down to $5,000, then it's sort of like saving the amount, that amount of money, and they would take a certain percentage out of that. Or you might pay whatever their fee is up front. But they're usually pretty affordable.
What sort of mistakes have you seen or heard about people making when they try to do this or maybe fail to do it?
The wrong solution that a lot of people do is simply, I can't pay this, and they sort of ignore it. You know, then it goes to creditors. So you definitely need to kind of face it head on. But you should also go through the bill, because oftentimes the billers actually do make mistakes. There are about 69,000 different medical billing codes. When there's that many out there, there's a good chance that they're going to mess up sometimes. So you really want to go through, and if the insurance company didn't pay for something, you really want to question them on it and make sure they put the right code there, because oftentimes it's just a billing mistake.
Jen Viechner is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and Market Watch. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find more tips on the art of talking your bill down. Go to marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
With you, my premium is low, my HSA will grow, and I'll get a tax break every year.
Poetry for a health policy? Plus, is insurance becoming the next 401k? That's all ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Most of us get health insurance through our jobs. Your company usually gives you one or two plans to choose from, and each payday, a little bit comes out of your check to pay for it. But there's a new trend emerging at some major companies, like IBM and Time Warner. Private healthcare exchanges, where you get a set amount of money and then pick from a bunch of different plans. It's an example of how the healthcare system is changing for everyone, not just people buying insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Alex Nussbaum has written about this. He's a health reporter with Bloomberg News. Thanks for being here, Alex.
Great to be here, Lizzie.
So explain these exchanges that companies are starting to use.
Sure. So these are websites generally where you can go and find a menu of insurance options. The idea here is that the individual worker or retiree can go choose their own insurance as opposed to taking the one or two options that your company could provide you through an employer-sponsored plan. And again, the idea, at least the argument from the companies, is that more choice will lead to a better deal for their workers, or again, their retirees. You don't have to take the one-size-fits-all plan. If you're relatively healthy, you can choose a plan that has higher deductibles but a lower premium, maybe choose a plan that holds down costs by favoring generic drugs over brand-named ones.
So the idea here is that you have more choice as a consumer, I'd imagine this also saves the company some money, too.
Right. That's definitely a part of it. You know, healthcare costs, while they've been slowing in recent years, they've still been going up faster than inflation for over a decade, certainly faster than employee wages are going or the fixed income that retirees are on. So the argument is that this saves the company money and that it might save the individual who's buying insurance money. For retirees, depending on where you live, the Medigap or Medicare Advantage plan you can find might be a better deal for you than what your company can offer.
So I'm used to having an employer who just kind of gives me one health plan or two health plans to choose from. If my employer changes to something like this, how does that work for an employee?
Well, it means that the burden of choice is going to be much more on you. There's going to be more choices, more flexibility, but it's going to be up to you to figure it all out. I liken it to the move from pensions to 401ks that we've seen over the past couple of decades, where now you are really responsible for your own investments and choosing the right one. And, of course, for a lot of people, that's a sort of real headache and induces a lot of anxiety. But for other people, they probably like the freedom.
Right, because I'm thinking, oh, gee, that might be great. But on the other hand, I'm not an expert in this. How do I know if something's the right thing for me? Are there resources for people to help figure this out?
Well, the companies that are moving people to these exchanges argue that they also can provide a lot of resources for the employees. They can guide them, a lot of tools online, a lot of people that you can access over the phone to help you out. But it remains insurance. It remains a real complicated decision with deductibles, co-pays, various doctor networks, and the onus is really going to be on the individuals to try and sort that all out.
You reported on companies that are thinking about doing this and that are considering doing it for their retirees as well. Are there any where this is already in place where we know what the track record is?
It's sort of a trend that is in its infancy. There are a number of companies that moved in this direction. Just recently, we found out that IBM and Time Warner are making the switch to private exchanges for their retirees. And the jury is still out as to what it's going to mean for workers.
Do we have a sense yet of how much money companies are going to give their employees to buy insurance on these exchanges?
It's too new to really say for sure. I was talking to one benefits consultant who said that the contributions are often about $2,500 to $3,000. But I know of some companies that have made this switch or just dropped retiree coverage and are not offering any stipends. You know, their employees are really, or their retirees, are probably going to see a loss, again, unless the Obamacare benefits or what's available on these Medicare exchanges, unless they can find a good deal there.
$2,500 or $3,000.
Per year.
That's not a lot of money to buy a health care plan.
It doesn't sound like it. It's a whole lot less than what companies provide often for their active employees.
Are any companies going to move their active employees to these plans?
That's happening already. It's more in its infancy than the move of retirees to these kind of exchanges. Darden Restaurants owns the Olive Garden chain and a few other well-known chains did it last year. So did Sears. They both moved to an exchange run by another company, Ahon Hewitt. And the early reports are that it's held healthcare costs down, including for employees. But again, it's only a year's worth of data, so it's hard to say. But the thinking is that more and more companies are going to move their active workers in this direction, too.
You're talking about some pretty big companies here. I mean, Darden Restaurants
right.
owns lots of restaurants. IBM, Time Warner, they're talking about their retirees. But those are huge companies. I'd imagine if you have great big employers doing this, it could mean other employers watch them and say, you know what, I'm interested in that option too.
Yeah, it seems like an evolution that may become a revolution in the coming years. Again, a lot depends on how those Obamacare exchanges do as well. If people see that that works and that sort of proves the concept, then the thinking is that private companies using private exchanges may become a lot more common as well.
Alex Nussbaum covers healthcare for Bloomberg News. Thank you for joining me.
Okay, thanks.
Healthcare isn't just about having insurance, but knowing what it covers. So how do you find out?
If you have any doubt of what's in your plan, go to your HR department or call the insurance company that sold it to you and say, I want to see the summary of benefits and coverage.
That's Nancy Metcalf of Consumer Reports. We asked for some tips on getting to know the details of your insurance plan, and you can read those suggestions online at marketplacemoney.org. Shopper, 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 health insurance is supposed to be a safety net with access to care, doctors, and treatment. And yes, policies range in terms of price and services, but there's a conversation that goes beyond the dollars and cents, and it gets to the heart of the relationship between providers and a patient, the quality of your care. And so many things can influence that. One of them is skin color. Minority patients get sick sooner, have more severe illnesses, and die sooner than whites. Those are all findings from David Williams' research. He's a professor of public health and African American studies at Harvard. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
You study racial bias in a lot of situations, but in healthcare, how does it play out?
Discrimination, racial discrimination, is ubiquitous within our society, and it affects both health and healthcare. Let me give you a concrete example. Dr. Todd was an emergency room physician at UCLA Medical Center, and he asked a simple question. When a patient comes into the emergency room with a broken bone in the arm or leg, so it's called a long bone fracture, the technical medical term, does the patient's ethnicity make a difference with whether the patient gets pain medication or not? So a patient with a broken bone, does their ethnicity make a difference? And what he found is that more than half of all Latino patients treated at UCLA over an entire year with a broken bone did not receive pain medication compared to about a quarter of whites.
Wow.
And so that's a huge difference. And so he was a good researcher, and he statistically took into account what time the patient showed up at the emergency room, how long they spent in the ER, whether they spoke English or not, what the gender of the patient was, whether they got injured on the job or not. And basically what he found was the single strongest predictor of whether a patient received pain medication was that they were Latino. Dr. Todd moved from UCLA to Emory University in Atlanta, repeated the same study looking at African Americans and whites, and found that a black person with a broken bone in the arm or leg shows up in an emergency room in Atlanta is less likely to get pain medication than a white patient. This pattern existed across every area of medicine.
Some of this data is from the late 90s. I know there's been more research since then. Does it matter what color the doctor or provider is?
What the research shows is that on average in the society, whites have higher levels of this implicit bias than African Americans or other minorities. However, some African American physicians, based on their upbringing, based on their socialization, also have negative biases of black patients. Can I add that these processes, although they have been well documented about race, it's not just about race. If someone holds negative stereotypes about gay people, about fat people, about old people, about women, it could be any social group, and you meet someone from that group, those similar processes take place. You will treat that person differently without actually being aware of the fact that you've done it.
It's not just about access influencing the kind of care, but when you have equal access, the care itself is different.
That is correct. These differences persisted even when we looked at patients, when we statistically controlled for having the same insurance or being treated in the same medical facility. And you're correct, it kind of complicates the access problem. So minorities, first of all, have lower levels of insurance coverage and lower levels of private insurance coverage. But in addition to that, once they cross that hurdle and get into care, they're receiving poorer quality of care.
How much money do you think healthcare discrimination has cost this country?
It's hard to quantify exactly how much healthcare discrimination cost. There has been work that has documented how much kind of disparities in health costs. That's the fact that minorities in general have poorer health than whites cost the U.S. economy about $310 billion a year is the findings of one study. And that there are two components to that cost. That is both the higher cost of treatment, that's, you know, higher levels of illness, so greater treatment costs. But the bigger component of that cost is what's called lost productivity cost. Because individuals have poorer health, then they have lower levels of productivity. They often also experience experience premature death. That means they're dropping out from the labor force at a time when they should be paying into the social security system and enhancing the overall productivity of the nation. So that we know that one component of the disparities in health are the disparities in care. And we know that they are therefore costly to the U.S. economy.
There's a huge impact on you if you're the patient and this is happening to you, whether you know it or not. If you're not getting the care you need, what can you do? How do you approach the situation?
That is a really important question, because healthcare context is a context of unequal information. You know, the average patient doesn't have the knowledge background to second guess what their provider does. And so the average patient is quite accepting of the care that they receive. For especially patients who are not very informed, don't know a lot about healthcare context, it is worth them going into healthcare context with an advocate. Could be a family member, could be someone with some medical background. But patients can also learn to ask the right questions so that they can ensure that they are getting appropriate care. Because I can't overemphasize the fact that the typical provider engaging in this behavior is unaware of the fact there is no intent on the part of the provider. We also need to think about what things a system can do to minimize this occurring among providers.
David Williams is a professor of public health and African and African American studies at Harvard. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Joy, it's good to talk to you. Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Throughout today's show, we've looked at a lot of the hard stuff in healthcare. Costs, copays, caregiving. It can be overwhelming. One of our listeners, though, is overwhelmed slightly differently. I'm going to let Sanjay Chinjiramani from Dallas take it from here. Move on over, John Keats.
My darling Humana 1 TX HDHP PHP-R-Medical IPP. It's high time I told you how I really feel about you. Last year, I found myself back in my hometown, working in the family business, quickly approaching my 30s. I realized I didn't have what I really needed in life, something I could hold on to in good times and bad. So I did what most people do these days when they're looking for a life partner. I went online, and there you were on that snazzy health insurance comparison website I visited. I was drawn to your low-maintenance monthly premium, just $75. That's less than a cable bill. You're also really laid back. Some say maybe a bit too laid back. They look at your high deductible and ask me, what will I do if one day I'm down on my luck and in need? Will my health plan be there for me? That's when I say, hey, back off, man. Chill. It's all okay. She's got an HSA. The health savings account is the best part of our relationship. I can put more than $3,000 aside every year, tax-free. If I stay healthy until retirement age, I can use that money like an IRA. So I tell them, don't worry about me, bro. You should check your own plan and see how good it is. Now, dear, I need to confess something. There are these other plans that everyone's talking about, these Affordable Care Act plans. Well, I went online and had a peek. You see, there was a WISE calculator, the Kaiser Foundation calculator that I used, just to try and picture what my future would be like with an ACA plan. It turns out I'd have to pay 3 times more per month for one of their plans with no HSA benefits. So I found out what I knew all along. You are the best, for me at least. So on this, the day of our 5-month anniversary, I'll say it. I love you. With you, my premium is low, my HSA will grow, and I'll get a tax break every year. What's not to love? Thank you, my dearest, sweetest health insurance plan, for being in my life. Lovingly yours. Subscriber ID 70051216 02.
also known as Sanjay Chanjiramani, and you can go online to marketplacemoney.org, and there you'll find answers to your healthcare questions, including ones about HSAs. Who knows? Maybe you'll love yours, too. All right, that's it for Marketplace Money this week. You can keep up with us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, calculating the cost of health insurance if you're self-employed. We answer your questions from our American Dream series. More details on college savings plans and retirement budgeting. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fraugali with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata, and help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening, everyone. This is APM.